The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. We've got an innovation and an admonition for this upcoming Super Bowl 50, the Carolina Panthers versus the Denver Broncos, to be held at Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California. Number one, don't celebrate your success on the sidelines too much, like Panthers quarterback Cam Newton. Someone should tell that to Donald Trump and Marco Rubio and Bernie Sanders, who all lost in the Iowa caucuses this week but still declared victory. But I doubt if declaring victory in a losing contest will have any more effect on Sanders, Trump, and Rubio's momentum and campaigning style right now than media criticism has had on that juggernaut Newton and his Panthers. In a moment, we shall see how hard it is to get the NFL to pay attention to a possible safety innovation to prevent brain injuries. We also note that representatives for the estate of Kenny Stabler, the Snake from Oakland, star quarterback for the Raiders, who was nominated this year to be inducted into the Football Hall of Fame, have publicly revealed that Stabler, who passed away at age 69 in July, was diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy after his death. The degenerative brain disease CTE, believed to be caused by repeated blows to the head, researchers at Boston University have found CTE in 90 of the 94 brains of former NFL players it has examined. Stabler marks number 7 of the NFL quarterbacks, usually more sheltered players of all of the players on the field, to be diagnosed with CTE. Lisa McHale has seen what CTE looks like before diagnosis. Her husband, Tom McHale, was a lineman for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He passed away in 2008 and was the second player to lend his brain to research and be diagnosed with CTE. Lisa McHale joins me now. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Is it possible for you to be a part of the celebration, this sort of national unity that comes every year for this football game where all these issues are talked about, but the game seems to be what matters?
You know, I have to be honest and say that I haven't been paying a great deal of attention. I haven't read or paid much attention to what's going on out in California, but I will certainly tune into the game on Sunday.
And how do you think the medical problems that have proliferated and the long-term effects of playing football, how has this affected the game and the sense that this is a dangerous business here, the NFL?
Absolutely. And it's been interesting to watch over the years since I became aware of the issue because of, you know, my husband's death, to see the changes and kind of how it has all progressed. And when I look today at what goes on specifically really within the NFL compared to what the game was like when my husband played, it's quite something. I mean, there are a lot of changes that have been made in the interest of player safety, and all of that, you know, all of that is good, is encouraging.
But nevertheless, the game has progressed to a point where the weights on the field, the style of play, and also the attempt to maintain the sense of rough and tumble are reaching a kind of a collision course. It's almost as though you can't have competitive football in the way that we've understood it, you know, a generation ago, and not have serious injuries.
I couldn't agree more. I think the bottom line is it's a dangerous sport. It's a collision sport. It was designed as such, and that's what it is. And so, you know, when you say it's great to see all these changes instituted to try to make it safer, I'm certainly in favor of anything they'll do to try to improve player safety. But I certainly have reservations about whether it will ever be a safe game. And certainly, I think we need to look at that very seriously when we're talking about kids.
What did you make of the movie Concussion?
You know, I think concussion was an important thing because I think it has done a great job of raising awareness. You know, we've been aware of these things for a number of years, certainly those, with whom I work and who are doing the research and people who have been impacted. But it's amazing to me still to see how much ignorance there is out in the general public. And so I think, you know, bringing it to the big screen can only be a good thing because it brings it to the attention of that many more people.
Was your husband's experience that speaking up about these problems was an indication of a lack of toughness and that the ethos of the NFL was to keep it all quiet?
You know, it's an interesting question, John, because my husband had no idea that anything he was going through had anything to do with sports-related head trauma. So he was not speaking out about any of this. And in fact, when he was going through the deepest of his troubles, we never looked to the NFL or to other players to find answers and solutions. So, you know, the perspective was very different. But certainly those who very, very often are talking about instituting changes to make sure that it's safe, there's certainly a lot of pushback from those that worry that we are sissifying the game.
I wonder if the activists here are not going to be the commissioner of the NFL or player representatives or even doctors or even actors in Hollywood, but it's going to be moms and dads who steer their kids away from playing the game, and the pool of players is going to diminish over the next generation.
I think there's no doubt that that is the bottom line. It's going to come from the parents as they become more educated and more informed about what the risks are. You know, there's so many other opportunities for their kids to engage in a number of sports and in a number of activities, all of which can create all of the positive outcomes that football does. And I just think there are going to be fewer and fewer parents pushing their children toward football in the future.
What do you hope for the next 5 years?
Just a continued awareness about the importance of taking concussion seriously. I think we still have so far to go in terms of educating the general public about what a concussion is and what the risks are to kids. You know, concussions, regardless of what we do, are going to happen, and that's okay because the brain, like any other organ in the body, will heal if we treat it appropriately, and we're just missing so many. And I think just we need to raise our children, you know, with this knowledge that a concussion's a brain injury and needs to be taken seriously from the time they're kids and growing up as they're able to take on more of the information and understand it better.
Lisa McHale is Director of Family Relations with the Concussion Legacy Foundation. She spoke to us from Tampa, Florida. Thank you, Lisa.
All right. Thank you.
Hollywood has made a hit movie out of the story of brain injuries in the NFL. Have concussions changed the way you look at the game? Miami, Florida. Football has always had an element of risk. It's part of the mystique, like auto racing, hockey, and not to mention rugby. While mitigating injury should be a goal, no physical activity can be 100% free of risk. Without it, all we have is checkers.
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. I know several professional football players who said that they would not let their sons play the sport due to the potential for serious head injuries. And that certainly has colored my view of the game.
Give us a call. Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. In the chaotic campaign season, there's no time to wait for some journalist to break a story on the opposition to help your candidate. The campaigns have to do the snooping and the digging themselves. Opposition researchers, called oppos, are an integral part of the contemporary road warrior scene. Todd Zwillick's latest installment of Road Warriors, Life on the Campaign Trail, introduces us to Jacob Daniels, attorney and senior partner at Oregon Research Consultants, and a much-in-demand Republican oppo man.
Sometimes we play as the silent partner, I guess, with investigative journalists. Other times, you know, these opposition researchers that people don't know very much about, most people don't know they exist. We go through all these records, a lot of information flows in and out of our office, and it's fun to watch the commercials, like where there's a quote where it says, Governor X you know, voted to raise taxes 10 times, and there's a quote and the citation to it. They come from the opposition researchers. We're poring over every single news article possible, and the payment really to an opposition researcher is to be able to see the information that they had to dig through for hours pop up on the TV screen and know that that information's going to help your candidate.
Are you looking for the sex scandal, the time somebody got arrested for drunk driving, or is it a lot more mundane than that? Are you looking for sort of everyday things in somebody's life that, you know, if you distill it, maybe doesn't look so good?
Well, that's a very good question, Todd. And basically, there's a few different components to opposition research. Number one, we're always looking for that silver bullet moment, that piece of information that you know is going to really be detrimental to your opponent's campaign. But then there's also just the more mundane components of opposition research, which includes just having a general picture of who the person is that your candidate is running against. And a lot of times that's really boring information, like how they voted on certain things. And then we kind of look and see if there's any silver bullet type issues with our client that we need to take care of or at least know about and be prepared for, so that the public relations experts that we work with have a response ready once that information comes out.
Give me an example of a time, I don't know if you want to mention names, maybe you don't, where you've sat down with a client, a candidate for office, and said, I need to know the bad things from your past so there are no surprises. What's happened?
Well, you know, when we do those sorts of things, and Todd, I appreciate you saying I don't have to name names because, you know, we do that in an attorney-client privilege type setting. I've heard just about everything. I've heard people think, oh, goodness, I had an amicable divorce, and goodness, that's going to be terrible. It's going to ruin the campaign. So I've heard that all the way to some things that I'm just not even going to mention that are just not good things that you want to hear. And so sometimes we have to then transition to the conversation about maybe politics isn't for you. It's a sport that is brutal, but I've found that it's even more difficult for the spouse and the children to have to deal with, you know, their mom or dad getting beat up in the media.
Have you ever felt badly for the tone and maybe some of the dirt that you've helped bring to politics?
Well, you know, I always jokingly say that my Achilles heel is that I have a great deal of empathy for my opponents. But along the same lines, there's a responsibility to make sure that we're obtaining the truth about the opponent, where at the same time they're trying to obtain the truth about our client, because in the end, what's most important is for there to be an informed electorate, for our democracy to work properly. And so,
yeah, but it's an arms race, isn't it? Because whether or not somebody's a good leader is one thing, but you're going to dig up their voting record, which is fair play. You're also going to dig up whether they had a bad breakup 30 years ago. Who cares? But that's fair play, too.
It is fair play. And you're entirely correct, Todd, when you say that, you know, who cares? Because that's kind of the element that we deal with. We find everything, and we take a throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks type approach. But yes, I don't like how dirty politics have gotten. It's one of those things where, as you were saying, it's an arms race, and if we're not doing it, we're going to be in trouble. Just like if the other side isn't doing it, they're going to be in a lot of trouble as well.
Describe the time that you did some opposition research into a home loan of your opponent back in a governor's race. Tell me about how that worked.
I got my first job after law school working for Chris Dudley, who played in the National Basketball Association for about 20 years. And basically, I just sat at a desk with a couple other guys, and then we just started going through all the information out there. We found this secret loan, which I would consider to be one of those silver bullet moments. When you get something like that, oh goodness, it gives you goosebumps, you get a rush of adrenaline, and that's the drug that we live on in opposition research land.
Did Oregon's former governor get a sweetheart deal on a home mortgage?
A secret loan?
Allegations of shady dealing?
Questionable ethics? Politics as usual. Oregon deserves better.
Jacob Daniels, that is opposition research come to life, or staggering out of the crypt. I don't know. There's you guys digging the dirt, pouring it into the sausage casing. And that ad we just played, that was the sausage. That's what you guys invented from all that work.
Yes, sir. And it's one of those things that I hear that commercial to this day. And you know, I'm so proud to have been part of that.
Tell me one thing, one piece of information that you've dug up on an opponent that you regret just it got out and you thought, I got to do my job, it's fine, but man, that person doesn't deserve that.
I'll give it to you this way. In order to actually do this type of work, you have to put yourself into a mental state where you just treat it like warfare. You just kind of get into that back and forth, and then maybe afterward you feel bad about it. But when you're in war, it's all about just making sure that you protect the people around you, namely your client, and you make sure that your client is successful.
Well, if running for office is dirty business, and it is, that means that somebody has to grab a shovel and start digging. And that's Jacob Daniels, attorney and senior partner at Oregon Research Consultants, Oppo Researcher. Jacob Daniels, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Todd. I really appreciate it, and I hope you have a great day.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. With real delegates now and real voters behind them and a virtual tie in Iowa this week, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders go one-on-one tonight in a broadcast debate in New Hampshire. Can they break the tie? Furthermore, how will the contrast in these two characters on stage shape the campaign on the ground from here on out? Christine Yonke is founder of Positive Communications. She's a speech and debate coach who has done debate prep for Al Franken and Hillary Clinton. Christine, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John.
Do you think the argument with Sanders and Clinton is going to be all about who's a progressive and who's not at this point? And how do you handle that as a coach?
Well, one of the things that I think is most interesting about this debate season is that there is a very high interest on the part of the voters. Research has been done by the Pew Organization, and 75% of people have said that they have watched at least some of the debates. But I think when it comes to the shortcomings in the debates, what we're seeing is that the candidates are not being well served by the TV broadcasters. What do I mean by that? Last night, CNN hosted a town hall forum, and I think it was a win-win-win. It was a win for the candidates, it was a win for the people of New Hampshire, and it was a win for democracy. The candidates had more time to go in-depth on issues and to answer excellent question on the part of the citizens in New Hampshire.
And when the moderators stay out of the way, is your view that we get a much more interesting reveal of what's going on with the candidates themselves?
Yes, that's exactly right. One of the dynamics that has changed on both sides of the aisle is that we now have far fewer candidates who will be on stage. This presents both challenges for the candidates as well as opportunities. The challenge, as you well can appreciate, John, is with just two people on stage, there literally is less time to breathe and less time to think. You know, with more candidates, you have a chance to pause and consider what it is that you want to say next. And also, the candidates have to be very mindful about split-screen technology. For 60 minutes, 90 minutes, 2 hours, they're going to have 100% FaceTime. You probably recall Al Gore forgot about split-screen technology back in the 2000 presidential contest. While his opponent, George W. Bush, was talking, Al Gore was sending all kinds of signals, rolling his eyes, heavy exaggerated sighs, and the voters didn't find those delivery techniques presidential at all. Now, on the opportunity side, what we should see tonight is more back and forth between the candidates. And frankly, that's what debates are supposed to be all about. It's comparison shopping time.
Well, I think that, you know, a debate would be much preferable to this, you know, journalist moderated business that we do in the United States. I come from the old high school debate team school, and I think a debate is a debate, and you don't necessarily need moderators of any kind. But I'm surprised at how the issues on both the GOP side and the Democratic side seem to be so abstract. Hillary is saying, I'm a progressive who gets things done. Sanders saying, no, I'm a progressive. You can't be a progressive and a moderate. On the GOP side, they're saying we've got to get our Constitution back. It's all this very abstract states' rights questions. And I just wonder if the voters connect with any of it.
Well, what Hillary Clinton has said, and I think it's true, on the Democratic side, what we have seen is a contest of ideas. And on the Republican side, you know, what we've seen is the hurling of insults. So what we can expect to see tonight with fewer candidates, hopefully there's an opportunity as you're suggesting, for the candidates to move out of the world of abstract rhetoric and talk more specifically about their policies. And we did see that last night. So if we've got good questions, we've got more time, so hopefully we'll be able to get more substance from the candidates.
Well, that is certainly the hope. Chris Yonke is a speech and debate coach, founded Positive Communications, has prepped Senator Al Franken for his U.S. Senate debates, and advised the 2008 Hillary Clinton for President campaign. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure to join you.
In the early 20th century, human beings became cogs in the giant manufacturing facilities that stamped out cars, cut out the shapes that were sewn into dresses, slacks, and shirts. Gradually, factory floor inventions gave most of the work to machines that, like robotic arms, are immune to fatigue and maintain their precision through millions of cycles. The people who made that possible were the working-class heroes of an era, people like H. Joseph Gerber, a refugee from Austria and Holocaust survivor, named in 1952 one of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's 10 most outstanding young men in America.
Only under our American economic, moral and social system, is it possible to grow, to compete, and to create as free human beings and as free citizens.
Gerber quite literally freed workers from the intensive and dangerous labor of manufacturing, inventing automated processes and machines that got him dubbed the Thomas Edison of manufacturing. Joseph Gerber's son, David Gerber, has just finished a biography of his dad called The Inventor's Dilemma: The Remarkable Life of H. Joseph Gerber. It's a story of magic and simplicity that began one day when Gerber's father shared his life-changing secret with his son.
I was probably about 12 years old when my dad first showed me his original invention, and he showed me how I could use it for art projects.
What was it exactly?
So this was a device called the variable scale, and what my dad showed me actually was an old pajama waistband. He brought me into his private office where he kept a lot of old memorabilia, and he took this piece of cloth out of a tackle box that he kept there, and he explained to me that this is what he used to start his company, and it was an invention that he came up with in college to solve engineering problems. It was kind of touching as well for me because my dad had been a Holocaust survivor, and that pair of pajamas was the one thing that he had been able to bring to America with him that his father had given him, and his father never made it out.
What is your understanding of what an inventor does based on your experience with your dad? What set him apart from somebody who just made tools in a tool and die shop?
He was very astute at being able to recognize problems, and he was able to see in an object a new use, a metaphor for a new kind of object that he would be able to create.
A metaphor for a new object. So he could look at what you and I see and see something else there.
He could. Maybe his most important invention was the automated cloth cutting machine for making apparel. This is an example as well of a whole new approach to cloth cutting. What he did was he resorted to far-flung analogies, things like food packaging, shoe brushes, airplane wings, not the kind of things you would normally turn to. You know, most engineers, if they were given the task of coming up with a cloth cutting machine, what they would probably do is open a book and look at designs of how cloth cutting machines were made. That wasn't my dad's approach.
Really?
He would ask the question, what are we trying to accomplish here? And he would often come up with very different solutions as a result of that.
We think of inventors like Thomas Edison who are responding to a need that is self-evident. And what you're describing is someone who comes into a situation that no one perceives as having some overwhelming self-evident need and says, you know, can we just like stop for a second and I'll do this a completely different way and it'll be a million times better.
Well, I think of this approach as being kind of like what Steve Jobs did. He came out with products that people didn't realize they had a need for. Mm. And he then embodied that in a system. And that system itself created new opportunities for more products. That was very much what my dad did.
Do you think his experience as a Holocaust survivor gave him an ability to see the waste perhaps better than some others?
I think his Holocaust experience had a number of influences on him as an innovator. He started out as a precocious boy who was inventing to cause a lot of trouble. He would electrocute the doorknobs in his room so people would come and get a shock and drop soup and so on.
What a delightful fellow.
Yeah, he was.
Jeez.
Well, it was encouraged in his household.
I got you.
And when the Holocaust came, he had to really turn his inventive talents to solving serious imminent problems. He actually saved himself and his family. He and his dad escaped into Switzerland, but then they were turned back over to the Gestapo and put on a train headed toward Dachau. And he figured out how to disengage a latching mechanism on a train car, so he and his father were able to jump the train. And there were a number of these examples. Secondly, I think the Holocaust experience gave him a very different view of risk. It was an environment in which if you did nothing, you're dead.
We talk a lot about how there's a quality of America that encourages this innovation. Is it possible that it's not really American at all, but it's from everywhere else? It just so happens that to be a fish out of water is what's required to empower someone to actually produce those inventions. And, you know, staying in a place like Europe, which is very regimented, you just never get the chance to do what your dad got the chance to do.
I think my dad would have said that being innovative is very American. When he came here, he later told me, he realized that this is the place he had always dreamed of, even though he never knew it existed. When he was a kid in Vienna, he was criticized for asking questions. In America, he was complimented for them. In Austria, people had what he called an anti-innovative attitude. And when he came to America, he saw that there was opportunity to express yourself. And he thrived in this environment.
Well, what a proud son you are.
I'll call it a grateful son. I was very fortunate. My dad was a better father than he was an inventor.
Well, that is high praise indeed. David Gerber, thanks so much.
It's my great pleasure to be here. Thank you, John.
David Gerber is the son of inventor H. Joseph Gerber and the author of The Inventor's Dilemma, The Remarkable Life of H. Joseph Gerber. 36 years ago, the Rams were an L.A. team, the Pittsburgh Steelers were facing them in the Super Bowl, and 52 American hostages were behind enemy lines being held captive in Tehran, pawns in an international crisis that would last for another year.
By special arrangement, this broadcast will be heard by the hostages held in the American Embassy in Iran, and we hope that listening to this broadcast will give you some small temporary link with home. You are in our thoughts and prayers constantly.
Honor America and show our support for Americans being held hostage in Iran.
But what the hostages heard was not a live broadcast. It was a videotaped cassette of the game, part of an oddball care package of holiday greetings arranged to be delivered to the hostages by L.A. local journalist Alex Payne, a reporter with KMPC Radio in Los Angeles. Payne arrived in chaotic Tehran in 1979, and while the networks chased the international crisis angles, Payne did what all local reporters do. He made friends with embassy guards, eventually got inside the American embassy, and delivered millions of Christmas cards to the hostages before dropping off that tape of Super Bowl XIV.
They brought me inside the embassy. They blindfolded me, bring me inside. I did get the first message from a hostage. It took a few days, but I passed in a blank cassette. And I said, could Jerry Plotkin say something so we know he's alive? And they had Jerry Plotkin record something, and I got that first message. And then in my contacts, I was able to talk to Jerry on the phone, which other reporters were not able to do.
And again, this local angle, oh, he's my neighbor kind of thing, played to the sensibilities of the militants who were pleased to be involved in this big geopolitical controversy and dealing with the Iranian government. But you couldn't do that 24/7. You needed to kind of take time out for the human element. And that
that was something that you were doing, whereas CBS and the networks were sort of in touch with Washington and doing that whole angle.
Right, right. And I actually got immersed in their culture that way. In those off hours, I would visit different places around the city, and I made friends with some of the young Iranian translators for the networks, and they would invite me to their homes. And so all of a sudden, I'm looking at it in a different way. Of course, there are militants, they're really terrorists taking over our embassy. And at the same time, I know Iranians, very gracious, very nice. Some of them supported Khomeini. Some of them didn't support Khomeini. So I was getting a real education.
As the hostage crisis itself worked its way towards a conclusion late 1980, when did you first get an inkling that before the hostages were expelled, you would have an opportunity to really do one kind of final gesture of goodwill between the American people and those hostages?
I arrived a couple of weeks after the taking of the embassy because I think all of us thought it wasn't going to last long. There had been other demonstrations, and even they tried to take over the embassy the week before, and it lasted a few hours. I stayed there until they gave the order in late January that all American reporters had to leave. They rounded up the reporters and they put them on a plane, but I had made a deal with the militants that I was going to deliver the Super Bowl. And the reason they allowed me that was they were fans of football. In my conversations with them, many of them had gone to American universities. They liked football. The clergymen who visited the hostages during Christmas time even said that the hostages talked about football. So I put those two things together, and I thought, well, the Super Bowl isn't at least a week after everyone's expelled. Maybe I can stay longer. My station, KMPC, was broadcasting it. It was the flagship station of the Rams, who were in the Super Bowl. So I taped that, and I was able to bring it in to the embassy, and some of the hostages got to hear it.
And now the LA Rams are headed back to LA.
That's right.
And you've lived to see it.
That's right. That's right. I feel sorry for St. Louis losing a team, though.
You really look like you feel sorry for that. Yeah, it's like you're really crying a lot of tears there, Alex. But what an amazing sort of closing of an arc 35 years later.
It is. And recently now the hostages, the former hostages, will be compensated, which is great, because after all these years, all the misery and the hardship they suffered, they got nothing. They still haven't gotten an apology from the Iranian government, which I don't know if they ever will, but at least they're going to get some monetary compensation for their hardship.
What was the scariest moment?
The scariest moment, it was in those crowds. I mean, it could go up to about a million people around there chanting "Death to America," and they're pushing and shoving, and there's some Revolutionary Guards are in the mix in the crowds, and some are not, and they all have guns. And they seem to all have their finger on the trigger, and you were always afraid that someone's going to push and you're going to get shot accidentally. Some of these kids had guns, and you knew they didn't have any training, and they were filled with this enthusiasm for the revolution, burning flags, pushing, and they see an American. And sometimes I even had to say, I'm Italian journalist, because there was so much anger against American reporters there. But at the end of the day, I just felt that as a reporter, I don't know, I felt like I had some shield over me that they're not going to hurt me.
Do you remember any of the militants? Some have made it into the government today.
Yes.
And some are back in the civilian world.
And some of them have regretted it, I've read. Some of them have regretted what they've done. I think the problem is the young people today over there are seem to be pro-American. It's these older people that served back then or were militants at the embassy. They were indoctrinated, obviously. Some of the stories, there's validity to. The U.S. had involvement in Iranian affairs. But does that justify taking those Americans at a different time in history? Those people at our embassy, did they have anything to do with the days of Mossadegh and all that, and the Shah? I don't know. I don't forgive them at all for the misery. Some hostages were tortured. All of them suffered a great deal, and I would never forgive them.
What do you think of the change between the U.S. and Iran, the relationship that seems to be warming and the nuclear deal? And what was it like to actually hang out with the hostages once they were released and recount your various experiences once you could be face to face without anyone bothering you?
Well, on the latter part, it was great. I mean, they expressed gratitude for me for bringing in mail and cards, which I said that was nothing. I mean, you guys suffered, you know. I'm just amazed at their courage and their and belief in the United States. On the first part, I think it was a mistake. I don't trust them. I think the nuclear deal is not well vetted. I just feel that the sanctions were working, and it all goes back to the Green Revolution. If our country had lent some support during that time in 2009, I think things would have been different.
Alex Payne, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Alex Payne is a journalist and the founder and president of Telco Productions. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for the search for America's greatest innovation is provided in part by the Lemelson Foundation. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.